Good morning.
You
know, I was thinking, should I ask Jack to, should I pick a song or just see what Jack has for me? I thought, no, as long as it's not Wind Wind, I'll be okay. It's, well, that or How Great Thou Art. Wind Wind makes me cry, and How Great Thou Art makes my mother cry. Which, by the way, there is a pool for how quickly my mother's going to cry this morning, so if you want to get in on some of that action, then let us know. We could have done it immediately with How Great Thou Art. So give me a few minutes here. One of the best things about going late in the week is I get to steal everybody's good bits. So just officially, no self-respecting Scoutmaster would have been seen with that rope that Uncle Don had. It was, short, frayed. Should you need it, and I suspect that many of you will, I do have my own hook so that if you have things that need to be hung on a hook, during this talk, you can see me afterwards, and the whole place has been treated for Japanese beetles, so we don't have to worry about that through this whole talk. Seriously, though, I am here this morning to take a moment to tell you about my soulmate, the love of my life, Earl Rainey. Earl, it's. You know, I don't even know where to begin, Earl. Just call me, maybe. It'll be okay. Honestly, though, I'm not here to just make fun of other speakers. But I did have a moment where I was led to this photograph. And after just a few minutes of photoshopping, this is what came out. I see a face in it. If you look real hard, I don't know, maybe it's just me. If you get farther back, it's a little frightening, isn't it? I didn't see it that large until just now, and it's really big. All right, with that said, if everybody would maybe just kind of close their eyes for a moment, we could take a few deep breaths and let go and try to find a centered spot. And Glenn Clark used to talk a lot about harmony and that need for harmony. And my hope is that going on the last day, we have been able to let go of some of the week, and that we can sit here and we can listen for what God has to say, and hopefully there'll be a lot more of what God has to say than what I have to say this morning. So just a moment to breathe and take it in. And I would just say, Father, may your words be done, and don't let me screw this up. So I got an email on St. Patrick's Day. It was from Kirsten, and it was asking me to be a lamplighter at this camp this year. I was pretty sure it was a mistake. You may not know, but there's kind of a cult here of portly, distinguished men with goatees and glasses and. And no, I won't play the trumpet for you, and no, I won't sign you up for stunt night. I didn't write a really cool book about the Knights Templar. It's just a thing. I'm not saying, if you don't want to be cool, that's fine, but the cool people have goatees. I won't defend you, Jay. I get called Jay all the time. It's the weirdest thing. But I was sure it was a mistake, and so I did what I do most of the time when I first feel the Holy Spirit tapping me on the shoulder, I ignored it. I just thought it would be embarrassing if I leapt right in and said, yes, 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 I'll be there. And then, 2 days later, I got the email and said, no, we meant Earl, sorry. So I let it kind of sit there. I figured this travesty would be corrected in no time. But a couple of days later, Kirsten sent me another email that just kind of said, hey, did you get our email? We'd really like you to be a lamplighter. So I did what I do the second time I feel the Holy Spirit tapping on my shoulder, and I asked for an extension. I said, Kirsten, let me pray about it, and she gave me to the end of the month. I took to about mid-April, I think, but it began this journey. Some of you, one thing that you need to know about me is I've run sound and worked around the speakers here since 1988, which is kind of a long time. I've seen a lot of speakers. I've heard a lot of speakers. And since about 1988, I've been arguing with them in my head. Am I the only person that does that? Does anybody else kind of sit out there and offer counterpoints and different perspectives in their own minds? So I've always thought that I had at least a talk in me. It was kind of one of those, hey, I could do that moments, and oh, the talk I could talk if they would just give me the opportunity. Then the opportunity came. And if this feels kind of like straight to the big leagues, this isn't like, would you do a morning meditation, or would you come talk to the youth group, or give a talk at a council ring? This is like the full assembled family with house lights that don't go down. I told Kirsten at one point, I was like, I don't know. It's such a blessing to be able to do this here at Winnie, but it's also terrifying because there are a lot of people here that can call me on everything that I say, every story that I tell. And this is here in front of you, in front of, my wife and my mother and God and everybody. By the way, Jay did told me that I should say that the two most important people in my life are God and my wife. So now that we've gotten that out of the way. So I felt this nausea in the pit of my stomach and this kind of just queasy feeling about the whole thing. But I prayed. I started talking to myself a lot. I'd have a commute in the car every morning, and so I started kind of giving myself talks. Started trying to figure out, do I have a message in me? What might I talk about? What are some of the things that I could bring to the podium? Taking notes, rummaging through all manner of things, old journals, old blogs that I've worked on, speeches that I wrote for public speaking classes, different biographies that have been written for me for different purposes, and I don't mean like books, but just like one-page things that talk about my career and things that I'm good at, it's funny. I think I mentioned to David at the beginning of the week. Sometimes I felt almost like I was collecting data for my obituary. But I mean that in a good way, right? I mean it not like it was a deathly thing, but more like if I were gone tomorrow, what would I want left behind? What would I want people to know about me? What would I want people to say about me? What would I want people to remember about me? And I found it a very cleansing process and a remarkable introspection of myself to begin to go through these documents and go through my own head and look at my world and see how many talks are out there. One of the other things that you need to know about me is I'm a scoutmaster. I've been involved in Boy Scouting most of my life. We'll talk about that at greater length here in just a few minutes because it's very significant in my spiritual walk. It's one of the things I sat down, I wrote a talk for every point of the Scout Law, the 12 points of the Scout Law. I thought, I can do this. And I pulled out topics from work. Anybody familiar with Spanning Tree Protocol? Anybody? Okay, well, there you go. One. All right, David, we'll have that talk later. But Spanning Tree does this wonderful thing where it's how networks communicate, and it does this wonderful thing where it listens on a port, and then it blocks traffic on that port, or it forwards traffic on that port. And so I went through this whole process of how symbolic that was and this kind of listening and blocking and forwarding that we all need to do. It's pretty cool, David. We'll have a good time later. I'll catch up with you. It was really an amazing inventory of myself and where I am. I wasn't always happy with the things that I saw, But sometimes I was amazed and pleased and overwhelmingly blessed by the things that I've been allowed to do in my life, by the people that I've had in my life, and the places that God has taken me. You may not know this about me, but I'm a sinner. I was planning to come here today to talk to sinners, so if there's anybody here that's not, you should probably leave now. I don't feel like I have any special insight. I don't feel like I have any special theology or nuggets that I'm going to toss out here. What I'm going to end up doing here in a few minutes, after we stop looking at Dana, is go through a couple of Glenn Clark's pieces that have been significant to me and talk about how those words have played out in my life. But, you know, basically, I hope that I'm here because I am mediocre, right? But in a good way, right? I'm middle class. I'm not, unless I'm by myself, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. I'm not the best looking guy in the room. Sometimes I'm the fattest guy in the room, but, you know, mostly, you know, you didn't open the superlative pages in my high school yearbook and see a lot of pictures of me. I you know, am kind of an under the radar, normal guy. I make mistakes. I make horrible decisions from time to time. I'm looking at her not because she's a bad decision, but because she knows about the bad decisions I've made. She's lived through the ramifications of most of my bad decisions. She was a good decision, for the record. An excellent, unbelievable, incredible decision. This whole process was kind of surreal, and I began to think I might actually have something to say, and that God could use me to take this microphone and be useful for a moment, and that God might really want me to say yes to this offer from the council ring. So at that point, I told my wife. Her response was, I took that as 100% support and emailed Kirsten to accept the offer. That was by a text, by the way. I couldn't bring myself to tell her in person. So I've spent the time since then, since kind of late March, on this amazing journey. And I would actually suggest that I've never felt more prepared or more balanced or more ready for a week at Winnie CFO. And something that I'll just toss out there, because it's occurred to me enough times that I feel like I need to say it. Some year it might be fun to pick out 30, 40, 50 people and tell all of them, prepare one talk because you might be called upon. Let everybody go through that process. And then when we get here, we can pull lots and see who's actually going to give their talks. Because the important piece of this for me is not this. This is horrible. I'm nervous, and this is not the fun part. You know, the benefit to me was that walk, was looking back through my life and studying where I've come from and hopefully getting some insight on where I'm going. So just a thought, you know, we'll throw it out there for the council ring. So how did we end up with this talk today? I can tell you that the basic premise of this talk has changed literally no less than 300 times over the past few months, including midnight last night. It was still morphing and changing. I do have some things written down, though. I tend to be pretty extemporaneous kind of guy, but I figured, you know, I needed something to go from. When we left home, I had this amazing sort of outline and this framework in my head for a talk on our bond of faith. I thought that it's a document that we don't talk about enough at CFO, that it's important, it's caused huge rifts. You know, one or two words in the thing have caused huge rifts between CFO camps, and I thought this is a powerful document, and it was given to us, and it's about our roots as a group and as an organism. On that, and I was all ready for it. I even sent out an email before I left camp with the bond of faith, just to kind of percolated up to the top a little bit and make sure that people had read it recently. But when I got here, and as this week has unfolded and I've listened to every speaker, it became clear to me that I had the wrong document. Really, what I was called to talk about is the divine plan. Everything that we've been through this week, or everything that I've heard this week, right, I guess I'll put it that way, has been talking about this divine plan, right? And that we, kind of the royal I, believe that God has a divine plan for me. I believe that this plan is wrapped in the folds of my being, even as the oak is wrapped in the acorn and the rose is wrapped in the bud. I believe that this plan is permanent, indestructible, and perfect, free from all that is essentially bad. And I started to kind of process that as I was reading through it this week. And every speaker this week has had some comment on this plan, has had some thread in their life that addressed this notion. Right? Who here believes that God has a plan for us? Why don't we act like it more often? Why don't I act like it more often, I guess I should say? Right? And it was, I think it was Wendy in morning meditation this morning was talking about jealousy and kind of the double hit. She had a little reading about jealousy, the double hit of jealousy. You know, that your jealousy creates in you a disdain for what you don't have and a disdain for what you do have. And that's how I began to, you know, that immediately hit home with me here. That when we try to stray, when we try to argue from this path, that's really what we are, is jealous. Where it's, you know, the grass is always greener. And speaking for myself and certainly, you know, some of the people I see around me, I wonder, you know, if we really believe, and you know, and this is Glenn Clark, but we get this in Romans, we get this in Isaiah, we get it in Proverbs, we get it in Psalms, over and over and over. The Bible tells us and Jesus told us that God's going to take care of us and there is a plan. And, you know, he will direct thy paths. But I don't, right? So that's kind of the message. You can leave now if you're bored, because that's really what I want to say, is if we believe that there is a divine plan for us, and if we believe that plan is permanent, indestructible, perfect, and free from all that is essentially bad, then every moment in our lives, where we sit right now, we are perfect. We are in the right place with the right people at the right time, always. And we need to embrace that. And I'm not saying don't go to college. I'm not saying don't improve yourself. I'm not saying don't get out of a horrible marriage where your spouse, you know, I'm not saying those things. But I am saying that it is about that journey. It's about that divine plan. And it is about moving toward God along that path, along that continuum. Because this is one of those places that you decide that there is a plan for you or you decide that there isn't. Once we make that decision, then we are free, and we are free to forgive ourselves, which that's been kind of a theme for us in prayer group this week. I know what's in prayer group, supposed to stay in prayer group, whatever. One of the themes for us has been, it is easier for me to forgive every single person in this room. 10 times, 1,000 times, 70 times, 70 times. But I can and I proved it going through this process. I can list every time I've offended God, I've offended my family, I've done my wife wrong. I can list every single one of them in my head. I could create a spreadsheet and organize it by date, organize it by alphabetically. And I work through it, trying to get rid of those things, trying to let that bubble up to the surface and release them. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I think that we all hold on to those things and just go, oh. And we don't have to. We don't have to live up to somebody else's standards. You know, one of the keys to this concept of divine plan is it's unique and it's defined for you. And my dad doesn't define my plan. The priest doesn't define my plan. You know, the Joneses don't define my plan, right? It's mine. It's all mine. And my goal is to continue to work to embrace that plan and remember that I'm on that path, good, bad, or indifferent. And I'll tell you some stories, you know, from my life and where did my rose begin to unwrap? At a rose-colored hospital. right? The big pink hospital in the hill. I was born in Hawaii, Honolulu, Hawaii, in 1967, which sounds very glamorous, right? Woo, he's Hawaiian. I never got to surf. I never got any fresh pineapple. We were gone before I was 9 months old. I never got a tan. In fact, exposing my belly, astronomers from around the world send me messages to knock it off so they can see the stars again. But this is where it all started. This picture is a little bit newer. This is a postcard from 1969, but I think is this roughly what the place looked like when I was there. And I told Barbara it's not a contest, but I thought I could win with baby pictures. My nana, I know that my kids value their nana like few other people. I certainly valued mine. She's the one that, I guess, named me. For the record, my name is Gerald Lee Kerr IV, so I've never been sure how we got Jay out of that or how that process all unfolded. There are even those that call me G. But this is where I came into the world. Now, I've wondered for a long time, it's not anything that we've ever really discussed, but sometimes I really feel kind of some pain from my mother's life at this point. Here she is in Honolulu, Hawaii. More or less, hadn't been, I guess she went to New York, but hadn't been more than, 40 or 50 miles outside of Baltimore, Maryland for most of her life, met this stunning young midshipman from the Naval Academy. More about him later, but was swept off her feet by this midshipman and was married in June of 1966. I think she's crying, folks, just if you want to check it out. So June of 66, she's married. In October of 67, I'm born in Honolulu, Hawaii, halfway around the world. And one of the things that you need to know about my mother is she grew up on a block where everybody knew her. She grew up in a little town outside of Baltimore in Howard County, Maryland, called Elkridge. And her mother lived in a house about 200 yards from where she was born. And mom grew up in that house, which was a four-room house, not four bedrooms, but four rooms. And you could go out the back door and you could walk 200 yards down and there was her granny, my great-grandmother, and her uncle and aunt. You could walk 200 yards the other direction and there was Melville Chapel, that was the church that she grew up in. And you could walk through this cemetery on the way to the church and there were relatives. And it was just this incredibly rooted upbringing. Certainly not rich. I don't think they really ever wanted for anything. I mean, it wasn't, they weren't kind of dirt poor. They ate and, everything was cool. But it certainly wasn't, two Game Boys and a cell phone. And I mean, it wasn't a wealthy upbringing by any stretch of the imagination. My pop was a factory worker. He worked for Martin Marietta. One of the best people ever, he was, but just very salt of the earth. And my dad's family, his father was a colonel in the army, and my dad had grown up in Thailand and Brazil and Northern Virginia and all of these exotic, crazy places, and they were sophisticated and had art and statues and fancy silverware and clearly were, for their time and at their point, a wealthy family. An army colonel made a pretty good living. And it struck me at an early age that, which family would I have wanted to be part of, because, and don't get me wrong, I adored my grandma, I adored my granddad. They were perfectly reasonable people, but from my earliest memories, I knew that my nana and my pop were so much happier, that they didn't have as nice of things and they didn't have as big of cars or as new of cars or as nice a place to live. But it was a very profound lesson, and as we walked through that, I became a happy baby. It's for you, Barbara. And I grew up, I think, a pretty happy kid. I was always the fat kid, but I was never for wanting friends. I was never wanting for things to do. I was, I was kind of a class clown, and dealt with being the fat kid by being gregarious and outgoing and having a good time. By the time we got to Virginia, when I was in the first grade, we also were fortunate that our house actually backed up to a schoolyard. So right behind my backyard was a number of outdoor basketball courts and a football field and a baseball field, and kind of just over a few hundred yards was the area we called the pit because it was spooky and there were probably hippies that lived down there. But we would go exploring in the pit and lived on the water, had friends with boats, and we went crabbing and fishing not anything that was a particularly striking or interesting about it, except that if we continue down the road of the divine plan, I believe that God had selected those persons who are to belong to my plan, and that through proximity, mutual attraction, or need, they and I are continually finding each other out. And I was very fortunate. I've already talked about some of those people. My Nana and Pop-Pop were amazing Christian individuals. I grew up Catholic, more or less, right? Certainly we weren't real prayer-driven or real Bible reading-driven, but my father in particular had a very... I guess I've always called it kind of punch the clock Catholicism. If you show up on Sunday and then you're probably going to be okay. But it was a reasonable church. There were some cool things about it. We actually started at Holy Family, and it was a new church, so we grew with the church through various school gymnasiums and cafeterias and. Had some neat experiences camping out on the land that the church eventually bought to build their building. Some things that were, it wasn't a bad church experience. And we had a youth group and we did cool things. But I certainly didn't feel fueled by it. But around me were some of these other swirling influences. Melville Chapel United Methodist Church, is that the full real name, in Elkridge, Maryland? I didn't get to go there, in my opinion, often enough. It was just like my grandparents were kind of 180 degrees out. This was sort of the opposite church of my Catholic heritage. This was, it was a little stodgy, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, but to me it felt fabulous and warm and loving, and they would bring me into their Sunday school classes like I'd always been there, and there was this horrible dingy basement where they had fellowship suppers that would just light up the room, and the pastor would come sit with us and we'd debate capitalism and the state of the world and Santa Claus. He was an big believer in Santa Claus, you might have guessed that, but it was this wonderful, neat little church family where even though I wasn't a member there, everybody knew who I was because they knew Irma and Ed. Everybody in town knew Irma and Ed, and if I was with them, I must be okay. What was the pool of when I was going to cry? It was fabulous. It was a special place to go to church. In addition to that, we had some people around the neighborhood. My best friend for many of my years growing up, Eddie Thalball's mother. I was trying to think of her first name, but all I can remember is Mrs. Thalball. She was the holy roller of the neighborhood. She was always taking us in and taking us to these various revivals and different church activities here and there. And it was a little high key for me. She would forever buy us books, these little daily devotional books, and she was a neat lady. It was one of my first experiences with prayer that was kind of amusing because any car ride with her was a never-ending stream of prayer, because she was praying, but that also led to her not necessarily paying attention as much as she should have been. So all of us in the car were praying too. It was a God-filled car. It was this little Mazda station wagon, like well before Japanese cars were everywhere, so it felt kind of tinny and but I used to, you know, in my head, I've always been kind of contrarian, and I would never have done it out loud at her because she was a big woman, but I found whenever we got close to our destination, she would begin this prayer for a parking place. And we never, ever got a good one. It was just like, I just always wanted to say, you know, this isn't working. But she was a neat lady, and actually it was with her and at her encouragement was, I guess, probably the second time that I gave my life to Jesus. The first was at a little place out in Chesapeake, Virginia, not far from home, called the Triple R Ranch, and it was a Christian camp. And we went out and we canoed and we shot bows and arrows and we rode horses, and we generally had a great time. And you know, we sang songs and it was always cool because I would have to get on the phone and sing the new songs I'd learned to my Nana. You know, these real simple sort of camp. It's the first place I ever heard Kumbaya, or, you know, Up in the Air, Junior Birdman, or, you know, my favorite, you know, Grandma's in the Cellar. Lord, you can't just smell her cooking biscuits on that greasy, grimy stove. In her eye, there is a matter that keeps dripping in the batter, and she whistles as the runs down her nose. So that's what I took away from Triple R. But it was there. They had the camp has an evangelical purpose. And I remember, and this was probably what, 8, 9, it was before I started going to Boy Scout camp. So I was probably 8, 9, maybe 9 and 10. But we had these camp counselors that lived in our cabins with us, and one year in particular, I was in the Wrangler cabin, and this guy was scary. You know, we would sit up at night, and he would tell us these stories of, you know, Satan, and I was just terrified, so the next day at one of their, you know, sessions down by the pond, they kind of did a little altar call every night, and I, you know, walked down and gave my life to Jesus, and was, you know, I was feeling pretty good about it both times. It wasn't that I was forced or that it was outside, and certainly I think it was part of my divine plan in both instances. Let me actually catch up to my notes, because I know I've forgotten all kinds of cool stuff. No surfing, no pineapple, blah, 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 punch the clock, Triple R Ranch. I'm staying on task pretty well. At any rate, even with all of those people, at that point in my life, and now we're starting to get toward Scouts in my teenage years, I certainly would not say yet that I had a personal relationship with Christ. There was still some of a fair measure of my father in me that church was what you did, you know, for a couple hours a week. You went on Sunday, you darn sure better make sure your fingernails are clean before you go, because God cared about that a lot, apparently. Just ask my dad. But there's more people to come. And it gets to... It gets to a point in your life where you really start to believe that things are ordained. So here's a quick story, right? I am one of the 972 people that are here because of Don Kroll. They're just not all here this week. But Winnie CFO, played a role in my life long before I had any idea what it was. Now, I'll save you the gory details of my time in military school, but for 9th and 10th grade, I was shipped off to military school. That could be another talk or a week's worth. But by my junior year, my parents had split up, and I had laid plans and convinced my mother to get me back into public school, that military school was the root of all evil. And so that plan worked out pretty well. But here I am on my junior year in high school, going back to First Colonial High School in Virginia Beach, to our local high school. So it's the second day of school, and I'm sitting in the front row in Mr. Hill's history class, which is First Bell, and this young lady, who I thought was kind of cute, walked up to the front of the room. And I would stop short of saying love at first sight. I think love is too complex an emotion. But I was certainly very interested at first sight. So she was walking up to the front of the class with a note from Mr. Hill explaining her absence on the first day. I should have known something about her attitude, that she's going to miss school on the first day. But anybody want to guess why she missed school the first day of school? She was coming back from Winnie. That's, people that are new, we used to do this the last week of August, for about probably 60 years. We did it for the last week of August. And the way the schedules overlapped that year, they missed the first day of school. Now, maybe we would have met another way, because what I came to find out, she was in my First Bell class. She was in my Third Bell chemistry class. We had the same lunch block. She was in Mrs. Heitschu's Algebra 2 trig class with me. There was clearly somebody that wanted us to get to know one another. I noticed her in First Bell and walked into Third Bell, and she's standing there talking to my best friend, Clee. And I thought, well, this might just work out. I'm gonna go meet this young lady. And sure enough, I walk over, and they're standing. You know how they have kind of the big black top tables that where two people sit in high school chemistry class, right? So they're standing next to one of those tables, and I walk over and say hello to Cleet, and Cleet, being ever courteous, says, "Jay, I'd like you to meet Bob." So I met Bob, and my mission became to get to know her better. Oh no, am I running out of time already? Wow, we haven't even got to the good stuff. And the rest is history. Move on. But it was, well, she knows some of the rest of it. But so that was kind of the second day of school. By October 26th of that year, we went on our first date, which was to see Blythe Spirit at the First Colonial High School Playhouse. And a few days after that, she's older than me. I couldn't drive yet, so Cleet actually took us out on her birthday. We went to Chi Chi's. I'm trying to remember what movie we saw. I should remember that, but I was just enraptured by you. I wasn't even watching the movie. She's threatened me that she was going to leave if I got too offensive. So one swear word, she said, "I'm out of here." So that chance meeting and it's led to this. And honestly, I mean, there's no Whitmers on here. There are people in my life that are significant, but this was a fun day to watch Rebecca graduate from college and have all of these people together in one time, in one place. And I just there's no way I can't see the hand of God when I look at these faces and recognize that these people were part of my divine plan. Beyond that, I believe that gifts like my family are many thousands of times greater than I'm now capable of receiving. I should therefore pray to increase my capacity both to receive and to give, for my power to receive is as great as my power to give, and my power to give as to receive, right? There, these things are directly proportional. And this is one of those things. I told you I did a lot of talking to myself in my car. I tried to always make sure I had my Bluetooth headset in, just so that when people saw me, yelling at myself, banging on the steering wheel, that they would at least think I was talking to somebody other than myself. But that led to some. That led to some car sort of themes. And, you know, one of the things that I thought about is all of us start on E, right? And we start as kind of these self-centered individuals that our spiritual side is this kind of this empty vessel waiting for all of these influences and all of these people to come touch our lives and build, right? And gradually we become more giving, we become more understanding, we become more knowledgeable. It's the perfect the hiding place story with the baggage. You know, we don't start strong enough to pick up everything that we need to pick up. And so I just thought about kind of our lives as this meter, right? As this gauge that, you know, moves across the scale. And it's one of the things that gives me hope, that's a constant process of that filling up, right? Ultimately, though, life really becomes about for me is this balance. Because you go, or I do, I keep saying you, like I'm preaching to you, I'm talking about me. I deal with this all the time. You know, where you leave Winnie, or you leave a really good sermon on a Sunday morning, and you feel full and you feel refreshed, and you know, it's amazing. This is nothing about Massachusetts, but I'm telling you, the Massachusetts Turnpike, spiritually, in like an hour from leaving this place, can take me from here to there. You know, I haven't shot anybody, but I have known road rage sort of things. I just, you know, and the Mass Turnpike is a great venue for it. But this is the balance. This is the struggle for me, is to continually find ways to make sure that my tank is filled, and focusing, dwelling on that plan, that divine plan that God has for me, is one of the tools that I try to use to make sure that I'm understanding the things that are going on around me. You know, if I heard 1,000 times growing up, that's not, I heard it probably closer to 1,000,000 times. My mother, everything happens for the best. My dad didn't feel that way all the time, and I sort of waffled between the two of them. Great quick example, my parents built this fabulous house, or had built this fabulous house, and I mean, it had a playroom, right? This was going to be the greatest house ever. And whatever, I don't know all the details. I was 9 or 10 years old, but we didn't sell the house we were living in fast enough to make the contract on the new house. And so the new house went away. We never moved into it. We never lived a day in that house. My mom, oh, well, everything happens for the best. My dad, looking back, looking in the rearview mirror, if we'd moved to that house, I would have gone to a different high school. If I'd gone to a different high school, Susan would have been late to school, and I would have known it, and I would have never seen her in her pinstripe jeans that I liked so much. And you kids don't know what you're missing. Pinstripe jeans were awesome. And, you know, so you kind of dwell on those things, and you go, Mom was right. Everything does happen for the best, you know. And it all traces back to a botched surgery. What, 75 years ago? How long ago was that? So, a little more than 75 years ago. So through all of this, right, I believe that the chief essential of life is to keep in touch with the Father and let the divinity that is in me manifest through me. Right? That's time. So that's the task for all of us, as far as I'm concerned, is as we leave here, as the week winds down, that we keep this in our minds, that staying in touch with the Father and letting the divinity, that divine plan, that just 45 minutes ago, we all agreed we have, or most of us, I didn't really count hands, so if you're a dissenter, please dissent. But most of us just agreed that there's this divine plan, there's this divinity within us. And my prayer for me, my prayer for each of us as we go back to the world tomorrow, is that we can let that divinity manifest itself. And at some point, I got all kinds of great, you know, Boy Scout stories and, you know, stuff that if you want to hear about some great lightning storms, I can tell you. Because this is another place that was a huge piece of my spiritual journey. Pop back to it. You know, the Scout Law, this was a lot easier for me to comprehend, you know, well before I could even manage the Ten Commandments. You know, this was 12 words that I could bring inside me. And much later in life is when I figured out not only is a scout those things, but our God is these things. And how many of you were involved in scouting at some point? Yeah, right? It's an unbelievable journey. Brought me closer to my son. And allowed me, this is where I serve. One last quick story. About a month ago, we had another young man reach the rank of Eagle Scout, which is kind of a big deal. I know there are a few Eagle Scouts sitting here among us today, and they're kind of a big deal. But I'd never, you know, it's easy to not think about Boy Scouts and being a Scoutmaster as a ministry. But during this court of honor for this young man to get his Eagle Scout rank, the mother got up and gave a speech, and this family is military, and they're just about to move to Germany. And one of the last things that she did in her talk was kind of look out at the rest of the family sitting there, and she said, "You don't know how lucky you are to have Mr. Kerr. I've never seen somebody that is able to love these kids where they are like he does." And I don't say that to brag. I say that because it was the first time I'd heard that, and it changed just on a dime my entire perspective about Boy Scouting and my involvement in Boy Scouting, because I felt like she was right. There's nobody in my family that would call me a patient person. Nobody. But it is the number one word that these parents use to describe me. They're just like, "I can't believe you have patience with these kids." And so it changed my view. And I relate that back to letting the divinity in me manifest in me and being that model, being that light for those scouts. So with that, if everybody, maybe we can just have a kind of a quick wind down prayer. Just thank you, Father, for this week and for these people and for this opportunity to share a little bit of my story. You had me over-prepared, as you so often do. And now as we go forward in the rest of our day, may we feel your love, and may we remember that every sin, every choice, every decision, everything that we do, Father, is part of your divine plan for us. Amen.
We've been talking it